Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan, and wherever you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Kayla Ann Crum all about her incredible new book, Darling, which is described as a teen girl finds herself lost on a dangerous adventure in this YA thriller, reimagining Peter Pan for today's world. Kayla has re-envisioned Peter Pan with a central twist that will send all your previous memories of J.M. Barrie's classic permanently off to Neverland. That is most definitely true, and I believe Darling is now the definitive Peter Pan retelling, and all others will be judged according to Kayla's incredible vision, which is dark, beautiful, and spellbinding. We talk about some current hot topics, including the issue of trigger warnings, fabulism, what Darling gets right about the subtext of the original Peter Pan story, the book, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, now that we can do that again, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. This should be done all year long, of course. June is, of course, Pride Month and National Indigenous History Month, so support LGBTQIA+ and Indigenous authors any way that you can, either by boosting them online, buying their books, leaving reviews, all that stuff. It's real easy to do. Also, that kind of support shouldn't end June 30th. Please try and be an ally all year long if you can, like my guest is. Kayla Ann Crum attended Dominican University to study fashion merchandising, but was lured into getting an English degree after spending too many nights experimenting with hard literary criticism and hanging out with unsavory types like those poetry students. She is the author of the award-winning thriller The Wicker King and the YA romance The Weight of Stars. She's a Chicago native. She's passionate about diversity and representation in young adult fiction and currently writes most of her work in the lush gardens of the Chicago Art Institute. Is all this up to date or is this old now?
It is all up to date.
Okay, perfect. She's here today to talk about her new book, Darling, which is being described as a teen girl finds herself lost on a dangerous adventure in this YA thriller by the acclaimed author of The Wicker King and The Weight of Stars. It's a reimagining Peter Pan for today's world. Kayla has re-envisioned Peter Pan with a central twist that will send all your previous memories of J.M. Barrie's classic permanently off to Neverland. I believe she called it Nick and Nora's playlist with significantly more violence. I said, this is now the definitive Peter Pan retelling. All others will be judged according to Kayla's incredible vision, which is dark, beautiful, and spellbinding. I got to say, I'm pretty stoked that she's here today. Please welcome to the show, Kayla Ann Crum. Hi, Kayla.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. God, I don't even know if I want to do this part, but it's hot topic time. I don't know if you were caught up in any of the discourse today on socials about content warnings and trigger warnings and stuff. Did you happen to catch any of that?
Ooh, I missed a little bit of what happened today, but I have been watching from earlier today.
Okay, so, well, I mean, it's more the same today, but so what happened was, you know, like Adiba Jirgadar and some other authors went to Storygraph and looked up, you know, what was said about their books. Because I guess on Storygraph, the users can post their own content and trigger warnings, right? Mm-hmm. They can add to the list anyways. And they were shocked to find a lot of content and trigger warnings that's like not even in their book. So it was kind of a shock to the system for a few authors anyways. So I just wanted to get your take on that, on trigger warnings and content warnings in general. Cause you know, you are an author who does post your own and you're very conscious of that. And it's important. I definitely think for sure, but it seems like maybe, and this isn't Storygraph's fault at all. This is not their issue. And they posted something nice today about how they're going to look to fix it. But you know, it looks like it's maybe being used as a weapon against authors of color in a way, because they put up some comparables to other books that weren't written by authors of color and it's just not the same. So what's your take? Do you have one?
I do. I actually feel pretty strongly about there being content warnings either in a book if your publisher will allow it or on your website if, you know, it's a little bit too late for that. I think that having some consideration as to people who are actively looking to avoid certain topics is kind of really important. I think in some cases, especially in the case of my book, Darling, having some of the trigger warnings might give away a little bit of the plot. But when people are like really seriously dealing with some issues that they'd like to avoid content for, having that a little bit of, you know, information about what could be in something that they're about to consume is like way more helpful and important. It's kind of like going to a restaurant and the chef made something and it's so delicious. And they know that, you know, if you just close your eyes and eat it, it'll be so good. But if you're like horribly allergic to like snails or bananas or whatever, it's more important that you know that that's in there than that you taste it and then all of its, you know, pre-prepared glory, I guess. That's how I feel about that. In regards to StoryGraph, I think a lot of people are kind of approaching this company. It's kind of a new company. Usually when you start something like StoryGraph, there'll be little things about it that you didn't know that people would use in a way that you hadn't intended or that people would use, but it wouldn't work out the way that you wanted it to. And we're still in the stages where they're kind of like, you know, fixing up some things and like tightening some stuff and dotting their I's, you know, crossing their T's.
Yeah.
So I think they'll probably wind up landing on some sort of middle of the road thing where if you are an author and you're logged into their account, maybe you can flag something for not being a part of the, you know, actual book or something, and they'll do a review and see, you know, what happens. But it looks like a lot of the things that were added to books of authors of color were by like maybe one person, because they say how many people have flagged it.
Right.
So like one person is doing it, which means that it's there.
Right.
I actually had one of my books flagged for a adult minor relationship that does not have a relationship like that in the book. Like it's just parents and children, you know?
Right. Yes. There is an adult child relationship. Yes. Technically that is true. Yes.
Yeah. Whereas like something like Darling, where somebody genuinely could be like, that's something, you know, that is an adult and a child, you know, that could be something where like that'd be fine if somebody put that. And I think that one, people are more hypersensitive to the work of people of color because we come prepackaged by our publishers as being a certain like loftier, like, you know, if you try this, there won't be any problems. Or if you do that, like just because we are marginalized authors and they do all this stuff to make sure that like marginalized people can see our work. So I think that there's like a little bit of an issue with that because people get to a point where they're like, oh, you know, this book should be perfect in all of these different ways and stuff. And they judge our work a lot harsher. I'm talking about not like on StoryGraph specifically, but just like generally speaking,
yeah,
our work
yeah.
is judged a little bit harsher just because we're expected to like know better, I guess.
Right.
But the reality is that one, we're one person with one, you know, marginalized experience. And when you aren't a part of a different marginalization, your likelihood of like messing something up or falling into a certain trope is just higher. Like I'm, you know, disabled in one way, but I'm not physically disabled. And my likelihood of accidentally using words that the disabled community has already flagged as being uncomfortable or, you know, talking about something in a way that just doesn't sound quite right is a lot higher. Mm-hmm. And then when you think about the demographics of the publishing industry, each book gets edited, copy edited, line edited by Wicker King, like 8 or 9 people copywrote that. But the likelihood that all of them were white is like, it's like probably 90%. So we're having to go through all these processes, and readers know that the books go through intensive processes, and they're like, oh, all these people saw this book and it still wound up this way. So it's more of like a symptom of a broader problem than a specific, isolated, targeted attack.
Right. I think that a lot of this falls on the shoulders of the reviewers as one. I think if you're, and this is assuming as an author, you're taking the responsibility of, you know, doing your own content and trigger warnings, right? Whether it's in the in the preamble to your book or just online or whatever. I really think it's a reviewer's responsibility in a lot, especially when you get into the nuance of things, because, you know, one of the examples going around was somebody just mentions Harry Potter in their book, like the book Harry Potter. And then, so the book was labeled as transphobic. So you can see how that right gets a little problematic. It's because without context, I mean, imagine what the world would be without context, right? It would be a nightmare. It already is a nightmare. I guess it'd be worse. But I really think it's on the reviewers to like t- take more responsibility when we do post our reviews or comments on a book, because we're getting, you know, we get them early, and part of the deal is, you know, in exchange for an honest review. And I think people need to be more honest when they post their reviews. And if there's something in there, like say, like, we'll just use the Harry Potter one again. If I read that, and while maybe it didn't trigger any transphobia for me, because in context, that's just not what the author meant at all, like clearly, then maybe I think that's my job to say, and listen, you know, mention, maybe just make mention of that. Mm-hmm. And I would just like, because I just don't think we can put that on. I don't think we can put that on all the author's shoulders. I really don't. I'm a pro author person, unless they're like a hateful racist fucking asshole. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm pro author, and I think we demand too much of authors already, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, authors navigate social media circles at all is a blessing. And I'm just waiting for the day when all of you just say, you know what, fuck you guys, and we're out of here. And because we don't deserve it. And I honestly truly believe that. I think in, when it comes to nuance and things, like when you get real, like, listen, there's grand, you know, trigger content warnings for sure, right? Clear, obvious ones. But when you get into nuanced ones like that, I really think that's on us, on the shoulders of the reviewers. And again, StoryGraph looks like they're looking to correct it, and that's great. Mm-hmm. Because I know StoryGraph was sort of like, and I don't know if it wasn't their words, it was more the community, where it was like billed as an alternative to Goodreads, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm sure this you know, caught them by surprise just as much as almost anybody else. So it looks like they're going to make some steps in a positive direction, which is great, because I do like StoryGraph.
It's
assholes be assholing. I mean, you can't. It's, I mean, like,
thank you, but also we're young adult authors, so some of our reviewers might be children,
right?
I think that it's worthwhile to consider that, like, the difference between an adult saying something like, "Oh, you know, this book is transphobic because they mentioned Harry Potter," versus like maybe a 14 or 15 year old being like, "Oh, everybody knows that Harry Potter is transphobic, so the fact that they're even talking about it is transphobic," and just putting it in there. That's something that I think this is like a situation that is worth talking about, like, sociologically speaking, but I definitely think that it's something that could be easily fixed with technology, in so much as maybe they can have like a couple of tags where, like, you can use them, but if you use them, you have to do a drop down thing of like a 20 word sentence of why does he put it there. So if they put transphobia is flagged, you put, you know, misgendering or something, and then readers can just see like what it was that person thought that was. But that's just something that, like, StoryGraph could do. But, you know, when it comes to reader reviews, this is like a very much niche opinion, and a lot of authors that I know that I've met aren't super into this, I guess. But it's important for me to understand what it is that my audience, the consumers who are consuming the product that I built, want from me as a product builder. I want to know what it is that I'm doing right, what it is that I can work a little bit better on, what it is that I'm doing incorrectly, and what things that I need to never do again.
Right.
And without being able to see how people are reacting to whatever it is, whether it is like a positive or they're, you know, lashing out or something like that, like, I need to know that information so that I can use it to increase the quality of my work. And one of the things that I do is I actually read all of my Goodreads reviews. I know a lot of people kind of shy away from them, but I read them and I catalog them so that I can understand what things that I can work better on.
Right.
You know? So.
And I agree, and there's value there, but I mean, there's some people that are just wackadoodles and are chaos agents. Right. So, you know, I can't, there's just some, I read some of them too, and I just don't know if there's much to learn from some of them. And that's a minority. That's not the general, right. It's far from mm-hmm. the general. I think it's a minority, but, and obviously we're all okay with criticism, mm-hmm. you know, as long as it's constructive, right. You know what I mean? Yeah. But, you know, there's, I think some reviewers cross the line, and also, I have no tolerance for the DNF reviewers. If you didn't finish the fucking book, you don't get to review it. That's it. I don't give a shit. If you, like, especially, like, there's ones that are on there that are, like, DNF'd at, like, 20%, sometimes less. And I've seen them still leave reviews. I'm like, no, you forfeited your right to do that. I'm sorry. Anyways, I think it's a really interesting conversation, and it's been going a lot of it online today, and I've been reading as much as I can, and I think it's a really interesting conversation, and it's important one to have, And you know, it's like you said, it's in progress. It's so we'll see, you know, how it ends up. I'm glad it got brought up, and it's, you know, it's sort of created a lot of important, a lot of threads today. But you know, having said that, let's encourage people to be nice to authors who are bringing these things up, you know, because it takes a lot of balls, I think, for people to put themselves out there certainly the way authors do online. And we shouldn't shit on them when they voice an opinion, unless it's like a horribly gross racist opinion. But it's just, if it's just to raise awareness about the publishing industry, the good and the bad of it, they shouldn't be attacked for it.
Yeah. And I mean, actually, since we're even talking about like authors being attacked for things, I think a lot of emphasis that is not placed on them, but should be, is on publishers being able to protect their authors.
Yes.
Like, if you're going to elevate a marginalized person that does not have that much capital, that is in a vulnerable position, mm-hmm. and then something happens and you just allow them to be harassed, mm-hmm. like, you know, why would you do that? Why are you making this terrible? Like, if there's a situation where, you know, the author's receiving a lot of reviewers or something's happening with them, like, a lot of publishers will just like let them, you know, it's their very first book. They don't even know how to react to anything. They'll just like let them just do whatever, and then only make an announcement when it's pulling their book from publication, or, right. you know, pulling it to be re-reviewed.
It's a different, marketing has changed so much because of social media too. Have you ever felt pressure from your publisher to be active or more active on social media, especially around release time?
Yes.
Yeah.
My publisher is really nice though. Like, I love my imprint and I love my publisher. They're really like open to me talking about certain things, but like I'm like an old internet personality. Like I was famous on Tumblr, famous on Facebook, famous on Twitter, not like crazy famous, but like enough that, you know, on all platforms, I haven't ever had less than like 10,000 followers. So, you know, I think they more want me to talk more about my book instead of like making people laugh. But there is pressure. But my publisher, my imprint, actually, I just got a new imprint. They sat me down and they were like, you know, if you have any issues, if you have any difficulties with this, you don't want to be on social media anymore or anything like that, we can assign somebody to do updates for, you know, you and figure that out for you and stuff like that. So at least at my publisher, they gave me an option.
Right.
And they were really, really supportive about whichever one that I wanted to do.
Right. That's good. That's nice to hear. Because like, you know, there's like Case and Calendar and wonderful people like that post mm-hmm. really nice pieces about, you know, to sell your own book. And I'm always of the opinion, like, your job is to write, you know, it's the publisher's job to sell your book. But social media has kind of really thrown a wrench into that. It's like, it's changed the way things are marketed now, but you know, like everything else, there's a dark side to it. And, you know, how much you're able to engage and pull back it's entirely up to you, right? Like it's everyone's different. People are able to do it and some people just can't, mm-hmm. It's always an interesting thing to me. And because of social media, it's like we, the audience, demand more of you, more and more. Tell us more personal things about you. What's this mean? It's like we can't get enough of you. I need every piece of you in order to enjoy your fucking book. If I didn't know what you had for breakfast that morning, then, you know, like, what's it all about? So like, that's the stuff when I see that kind of activity going on, and I'm just, it makes me real nervous and fearful for authors. And that's sort of when I come back to, like, you know what, they're just going to leave one day and never come back. and it would be our shame because all great stuff. Thank you for having that conversation. I know it's not like happy fun time stuff to talk about, but it's important, I think, just because it happened today. So I've been thinking about it a lot the last 2 days, and it's a thing. It's a thing. On a happier note, this past weekend I was watching Pride Book Fest, the very first Pride Book Fest, mm-hmm. and a wonderful event. And I've talked to those guys at Steve and them that put it on, and it was mm-hmm. really, really cool. And I hope it did well, and I hope that they do more, obviously. And one of the many panels, of course, I saw was yours. And because this was catered to identity so much, I really loved your answer about your bi identity and how you've been out, you know, quote unquote, since, you know, for forever, since you were very young, and you had this idea that when you were young that you just figured everybody was bi. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until you faced homophobia that you realized that's not the case. That idea, I really felt like that connects to, like, that seemed like a Peter Panish mandate to me in a way, like this idea that everyone's bi. It's like, it's like you want to protect, he wants to protect the Lost Boys from that hate, right? From that homophobia, from the whatever. If you just talk about that for a second, because it was such a really nice, because usually that's not the case. Usually most people, when it comes to their identity, it's later in life.
Mm-hmm. I grew up, my mom was a teacher, and she got divorced from my dad when I was like two. So I was in a very, like, you know, single mom, you know, who's very, very nurturing kind of household. And she's actually a speech language pathologist. She spends a lot of time with people who struggle with all sorts of things. And so she spent a lot of time putting effort into me very, very young in regards to, like, loving myself and understanding myself. Mm-hmm. So very, very early on, I had been, for lack of a better word, coached to understand that the way that I was simply the way that I was, and how other people treated me because of it was more of like an issue with them than with me in the way that I come. And she, you know, was teaching me that to help me deal with, like, racism. But when you're a kid, you just absorb a lesson, and however you learn it is how you're going to apply whatever it is that you got. So I just kind of applied it to every aspect of myself. But when I was younger, I thought that everybody was bi, and I thought that people who were married and had children mostly chose a partner of, you know, a gender that would allow them to do that because they liked kids, and that was just what they wanted for their lives, whereas everybody else was kind of like doing whatever they wanted. And if you think about what it's like to be a kid looking at adults in the early 90s, there is no information that would come naturally to contradict that.
It's a beautiful story, and we're born the way we are. Are we all born pan? Are we all born bi, maybe? And through, you know, environmental stimulus and impact and the way you're raised and the part of the world you're raised in, you end up, you know, like going one way or the other, and you know, repress certain feelings, and, you know, because of all the things I just said. And I just started like going down this rabbit hole of, imagine, you know, we were all born Kaylas, like beautiful, perfect little, you know, right? Little humans who have this really great view of the way it should be. Like, I am, and kudos to your mother, who sounds like a beautiful, smart woman. Like, what a great way to raise a child. Be you. Don't fucking worry about what other people think, right? Like, that's their problem. That's not your problem. And I just started thinking about that. I'm like, what a great way to raise a child, and what a great way to be as a race, if that's the case. I'm just rambling. And I thought, what a beautiful place it would be if we all had moms like like Kayla's. If we were all, if there was more Kayla's in the world, it'd be a better place, is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, and it's just such an interesting thing to put it. And again, like, I instantly thought of Peter Pan, the story of Peter Pan, a little bit too, with, in that sense that, like, where he's just like, his heart's in the right place, I guess. I don't know. Like, you know, it was a great panel. You were great on it, and it was a great weekend. And I'm really happy that those guys were able to put that together, because it's a lot of work putting those things together. And I'm still just catching up too, because the Bronx Books Festival was this weekend too. So I'm trying to catch up on those panels. All right, let's get inch a little bit closer to Darling here. But one of the things in that wheelhouse, but fabulism.
Yes.
So if you're listening to this podcast, you should know what fabulism means. I've talked about it before, but that's the act of defying or busting genre constraint, essentially. But what does fabulism mean to you?
Well, I fabulism wasn't something that I kind of academically sat and started deciding that I wanted to write.
Yeah.
It's something that I kind of just like have a fascination with, because so I'm, tomorrow I will be 30 years old, but today I'm 29. And so I grew up in like 1996 2006 through 2002 was when my like youth was, my childhood, not teenager, child.
The boy band era.
Yes. And I wasn't particularly boy bands either. Like
neither was I. Yeah. I was like if you didn't listen to Radiohead, we didn't hang out in the late 90s.
Oh God. No, I was into like Joni Mitchell and other things like that.
Oh, fine Canadian. I'm in Toronto, by the way. I'm Canadian. So thank you. Nice little Canadian.
Yeah. But yeah, so during my formative years, Fabulism, even though we weren't using that word to really describe it as such very often, was very, very popular. So like the book Holes, you know, there were just a lot of books where it was like, this is a regular life, but there is something about it that either feels magical enough to make this book almost a fantasy, or it is a fantasy, but that feels very, you know, contemporary. Like A Wrinkle in Time is a fantasy that feels very contemporary when you're reading it. Like they're in places doing fantasy stuff and whatever, but like nobody's really talking about the fantasy. They're talking about the like human parts of it, the, you know, social aspects of it. So there was a lot of kind of like crossover with that experience for that era. So it's something that I really, really love because it feels to me to be a type of book that was designed to, I guess, influence children to see more magic in ordinary things.
Right.
That was like very much the feel of that. Whereas like today's media is very much about escapism. It's like, what you've got right here is like, whatever. And then, you know, we're going to a new world, a new land to explore, you know, whatever. I have no feeling about which one is better, but that's just kind of like what children's media is about right now. Being a hero, being somewhere where you're the chosen one, doing that. A little bit about, if it is contemporary, a lot of it is about learning a lesson. Like this book is to teach you to be a better person, you know? Whereas like a lot of books that were from the era that I was growing up were about trying to teach certain things and create fantasy. Like, what is it? A Series of Unfortunate Events. It's not fabulism, but it feels magical. You feel like you're going to a different place. And only when he says something about like cell phone or, you know, whatever, like, do you remember that this is supposed to be like modern, like an elevator? It's right. Modern set, right. But it feels right. Fantastical. So for my own work, what I wanted to do was to create a place, like a town, a very ordinary Midwest American town where things happen that are fantastical, but realistic, you know? And the feeling of magic isn't so much because something magical is happening or something unexplainable is happening. It's more because of how realistically the people talk to each other and how very much on the edge of, is this something that could really happen? It could be. But for all of my books, I do extensive research, both like science research and like historical research, to make sure that anything that I write is something that has happened and can happen.
Fabulism is so easy. It's easy to define in one way, but it's hard in another, right? Like, cause like you said, it's like, it's supposed to blur the lines, isn't it? Right. It's supposed to sort of like dance in between a couple of different more established genres, like you said. Like, we usually have that clear line between fantasy and you know, speculative or contemporary, right? So it's it's sort of likes to weave and bob and duck and dodge, you know, and sort of wrap itself, coil itself around all of those ideas. And, you know, it leans into abstraction in so many ways, but like you said, then all of a sudden somebody whips out an iPhone and you're like, what? You know, like, you know, all right, we're in New York. Yeah, we're not on, yeah, or wherever, right? Or Chicago. Why would I say New York? We're talking about Darling. I should be saying Chicago. But anyways, I thought, yeah, so it's such an important way to express yourself and tell a story. And I'm in love with it. I love the concept. I love reading it. And you do it really well. Darling, do you want to practice like a pitch, or do you have a pitch memorized, or you want me just to read the summary? It's actually wonderfully short.
The summary.
Yeah, no. On Wendy Darling's first night in Chicago, a boy called Peter appears at her window. He's dizzying, captivating, and beautiful, so she agrees to join him for a night in the town, as one would. Wendy thinks they're heading to a party, but instead they're soon running in the city's underground. She makes friends, a punk girl named Tinkerbell, and the Lost Boys Peter watches over, and then she makes enemies, the terrifying Detective Hook, and maybe Peter himself, as his sinister secrets start coming to light. Can Wendy find the courage to survive this night and make sure everyone else does too? I guess that's an okay summary. It's promotional language. So you start this book out with a quote from Barry's book.
Mm-hmm.
This book is beautiful, by the way. I remember I was the one who sent you the pictures of it before you even.
Yeah, they finally gave me copies. I literally got them yesterday. So for people who don't know, generally in publishing, you get a copy of your books a month out or something, or at least arcs, maybe 3 or 4 months out. So you have this physical copy of your book and it's real and in your hands. Darling is coming out next week, and I didn't get these until this week. So for me, Darling has been a series of emails that have lasted a year and a half.
I told you this, I love this book. I love the cover. I love the presentation. Mm-hmm. I love the binding, underneath looks great. The spine looks amazing. It's really great, really wonderful. And kudos to the team who put it together. I know authors don't usually have much to do with the cover, but I have to assume you were pretty stoked when you saw it.
Actually, they give me creative control over my covers.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Awesome.
Nobody else gets it. Really.
No, I was going to say, that's rare. Yeah. So that's, then you've got a talent because it's, I love it. I really love it. So you start off with a quote from J.M. Barrie's book, Peter Pan. And what I like about the quote is it sets the mood, obviously, but it also tells anyone who's maybe only familiar with the Disney cartoon that this isn't the Peter Pan that you're probably used to or have perceived necessarily. It sort of lets you know that shit's about to get real. It's going to be a little darker than you're used to. So I really appreciated the fact that you do that. It's kind of a content warning, isn't it? isn't it? It lets you know this. So if people aren't familiar, and this isn't and again, this is a chapter by chapter retelling of Barry's work, and which is a really fucking cool idea, by the way. And people are gonna, people are gonna steal that. But yeah, for sure. I think it's a really great quote. It sets the tone beautifully. This is gonna be dark. Get ready. And it also tells you, if you're not familiar with the source material, it's not a lot of singing in it. One of the things I wanted to do right away then on that note is sort of get dark a little bit right away. Peter Pan's one of those stories that if you take it at face value, it's a fool's paradise, but it's also a nightmare, right? It's the fantasy and the nightmare.
Yeah.
Do you think, I haven't read Barry's book in years. It's decades. I'm old. Do you think, is there enough subtext in the source material to infer something nefarious? Or are we just sort of because we know so much now, or we think we know so much now, that, our innocence sort of has been erased and we just, we know so much more about the evil in this world that we look at things like that now and we're able to, manufacture subtext in a way that we didn't before. And this is a lot of people don't even know Barry's own, his real relationship with with Michael Lewin Davies. And it was kind of an odd relationship, and I'm not implying there was something evil going on there, we don't know, but it was a long time ago. But is this just a thing of we're just so cynical now? Because I remember watching Back to the Future in 1985 or whatever. I didn't think there was anything wrong with Doc Brown hanging out with a 17-year-old, right? I had no issue with that. But now everyone brings, that's the first thing people bring up. Is that a weird relationship? Why would a 50-year-old man be hanging out with a 17-year-old? And why are the parents okay with this? And whether it's innocent or not, who's to say? I guess I don't know. I know Bob Vail has come out, the writer, and said, no, he's fine. They're just friends. Relax. Mm-hmm. But what's your take on it? I don't think you have to reach very far to look for darkness in Peter Pan, but.
Peter Pan was designed in a really specific way. By J.M. Barrie. It was designed to be read in one way by children and in other way by adults. A lot of what we believe or have, our association with Peter Pan is directly impacted by the Disney movie. The Disney movie came out a really long time ago. At this point, we consider it to be just as historical as the book. And I'm sure there are people who just remember the book as being basically what the Disney movie was. And it really does not read like that. There are moments from the beginning to the end of the book where Peter is doing something that is very inappropriate, that is making the children uncomfortable, or is very, very dangerous. all the way until the end that is extraordinarily foreboding. And when you're a kid and you're reading this, you're having like a, you know, oh, it's an adventure and they're going this and they're going to do that. And oh my God, they're flying in the sky and then they're going to fight pirates. And it feels like an adventure story. But as an adult, when you're watching not the dialogue of the things that Peter is saying and then what the children are saying back, but like what J.M. Barrie is saying in between that dialogue about what's going on, it's absolutely an uncomfortable situation. In particular, I don't know if many of you care to read the original book. It's for free on Gutenberg Library online. When I was sending out ARCs, I was also sending out copies of that as well. In the beginning, when the children go to fly all the way to Neverland, in the Disney movie, it's kind of like this romp where they're in the sky and they're experiencing all the stuff and there's fairy dust and everything like that. In the book, they go to fly. It takes, I don't know, maybe like 3 or 4 hours for them to get there, like a significant amount of time. During the time that they are there, Peter disappears several times, comes back, does not remember who they are. They have to reintroduce themselves to him because they're really pushing this thing where it's like Peter's memory has issues and he also has no empathy. So like, they're like, oh, he's flying around them really fast, too fast for them to keep up. He can't remember that they just learned to fly today. And there's just like all this language about like what's happening is inappropriate. There's this part where they're, where they meet the indigenous people, the, you know, racism of the time, whatever. And Peter is being really, really racist in front of Wendy. And I mean, people were racist in the past, but they did have the concept that some people were more racist than others and like that it was socially inappropriate to be that racist. And he was like saying some stuff and Wendy's just like, oh my God, like, should I say something about what he is saying? And she looks over at the Lost Boys and the Lost Boys are like, don't say anything. Like they just kind of are like, just no, you know? And then at the end of the book, when, you know, Peter comes and he's visiting Wendy and her own daughter, because apparently they live in the same house or something. And you know, Wendy's like, oh my God, it's Peter. And Peter just ignores her because she's no longer of use to him as an adult and as a grown woman. And it doesn't matter that they had all these adventures and memories. And then her own daughter is like, oh, you know, you can't understand. I'm going to go hang out with Peter and whatever. Like, he doesn't want to hang out with you. And she realizes that Peter is habitually preying on women and children. And then there's this part in the that I put at the beginning of Darling that is a direct quote where they talk about the fact that he kills people. And they mention it like 3 or 4 times, but these are the two like most obvious ones. But the two quotes are, the boys in the island vary, of course, in numbers according as they get killed and so on. When they seem to be growing up, which is against the rules, Peter thins them out. So Peter is the only boy in the original book that is immortal. Everyone else is mortal. He just kills them. And then it says, he often went out alone. And when he came back, you were never absolutely certain whether he had an adventure or not. He might've forgotten it so completely that he said nothing about it. And then when you went out, you found the body. And on the other hand, he might say a great deal about it. And yet you could not find the body.
This is what I was saying, right? When you started the book with those quotes and you set the tone right away and you let people know that this is going to be, you know, not maybe what you're used to thinking about Peter Pan, right? This isn't Robin Williams on wires, right?
Absolutely. The reason why I wanted to make it a chapter by chapter adaptation and so close to what actually happens is because what I wanted to do wasn't to take my own spin on Peter Pan. I wanted to take what was already there and elevate the parts of it that we have forgotten. And the only that part was the part we were able to look at.
Right. It's funny how that, like the darker stuff has been, you know, not dismissed outright, but it doesn't, they lean into the sort of, like you said, the fantastical, it's great being a kid elements more than child abduction, but for example. That was one of the things too that I really appreciated about your book was, you know, and you know, there's more than a few Peter Pan things going around the last few years because, you know, copyright and stuff like that has been lifted. So there's just, it's sort of an open field at this point. And, you know, reading Aiden's book earlier this year, which I really enjoyed, Lost in the Neverwoods, which I recommend definitely, but it's a different take than yours. But at the same time, I kept reading it though, and I kept wanting it to go darker. As much as I enjoyed it, I kept thinking, man, this needs to go a little darker. And when it starts to go dark, it, you know, Aiden pulls it back a little bit because that's the book he's telling. That's the story he's telling. It's a different version, right? No, I'm not saying it's better or worse. I'm just saying it's different. Yeah. I enjoyed it, but I kept wanting it to go darker. And I remember reading it and getting to the end of it. And I was talking to you know, I think Dahlia Adler at the time too. And she's just like, oh, what'd you think of it? And I'm just like, I kind of wanted it to go a little darker. It's because she, I just kept wanting. And then I read Darling and I'm like, this is perfect. This is exactly, what I want. Because, you know, being, I hadn't, like I said, I hadn't read the original book in so long, but I remember being like, yeah, this isn't like, and then seeing, you know, like the modern day Peter Pan's, the movie, the cartoons and stuff. And I'm like, this is not exactly what happened, but you know, whatever, like, let's say la vie, I guess. The world needs more fun, so let's just, you know, not going to make a big deal out of it. But so that's what I like when I said that earlier about like where I posted that online, where I really think this is the standard now, your book. And I honestly, I mean that, no bullshit. Like I just, this is, I think, is what people are going to think of when I think of Peter Pan now. And I think that's the way it should be. Like, I think that's perfectly fine. One of the things that happened that I liked early on, I love Eleanor, by the way, you know, besides the great line about vegans and serial killers, I was saying offline, I'm a vegan. So I, you know, the fact they're not mutually exclusive, serial killers and vegans, I thought was a funny line. I like how Wendy's parents didn't trust Eleanor because Wendy met her online. They'd never met face to face. So when she moves to Chicago, this is their chance to meet finally face to face. And her parents were a little skeptical because it was an online meeting, right? And so, and it, that's a new development too, right? This idea where, you know, people meet online, never meet ever face to face in some cases, and then some, and sometimes they do eventually meet online. And it's funny how we have this thing now where, no, you can't trust anyone online, you can't meet them. But I remember being a kid and being like out at all hours of the night. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to so-and-so's house. And like, who's that? I'm like, oh, just someone I met. They're like, okay, have a nice time. It's just like, you know, right? There was no, but now, heaven forbid, I talk to somebody online and it's like, no, that person's probably a serial killer. You know, you cannot absolutely go meet them. So I thought that was a funny take on sort of on just the safety culture and parenting in general. And I'm just wondering, like, if that was something you'd put a lot of thought into, like,
It is actually one of my favorite things, or an integral part of the Kayla Ancrum brand, is generational relationships and how what parents experience influences what their children do. And it's something that was in The Wicker Kings, something that's in The Way It Starts, and it's something that's in Darling. So Wendy Darling's mom, she experiences a very like violent situation with a bunch of kids that she met back in like the 80s or something, or the late 70s, when she was a teenager herself, like a young teenager. And it has influenced her trauma in regards to certain aspects of things that happen in the book. So she grew up in Chicago, she moved to the suburbs, met some guy, then they moved back to the city because they wanted to adopt some children, as the plot of Darling goes. Mm-hmm. And she gets really, really anxious when she's riding the train because of what happened. And she's visibly anxious in front of her daughter, Wendy, the main character. She also has feelings about Wendy meeting people whose parents she doesn't meet first.
Right.
There are a couple of reviews on it since, you know, reading the reviews, a couple of reviews in it where people are like, you know, oh, her parents seem so strict, but they left her at home with, you know, a window that doesn't close. Wendy's parents aren't a caricature of strict parents. They are strict parents in the way that children who grew up with strict parents understand that strict parents are, meaning their parents feel like the outside world is where the danger is. So if something is happening inside of the home, they're not as, you know, they're like, oh, you know, your window's broken, just fucking deal with it. I'll come back and we'll fix that later.
But stack some books. Stack some books.
We'll figure it out ourselves. Yeah. Them being like, you meeting up with some girl that you don't know, you know, just doing all this stuff and wandering around the city, like, that's not safe. You're not going to do that. And that's what the experience of other reviewers who clearly have strict parents talked about Wendy's parents. So they're designed by the trauma that the mom experienced has influenced the style of parenting and what it is that Wendy is not allowed to do. So like, I'm pretty sure that if they were like, oh, you know, you can stay out all hours of the night with your mom or your friends whose parents we've met, you know, you could do that. You can go berry picking with your friend and her parents, you know.
Right.
But like, what it was that Wendy wanted to do was have a like an independent adult moment and go and do this thing. And her parents being like, I trust you in our house, versus I trust you out in the street is like a completely different style of, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that comes out in her later on in the book, especially this concept of, you know, home is safe, home is trust, home is love. Because I mean, so many times throughout the night, and I remember being young and out on the streets and being in some situations I shouldn't have been in, where I'm just like, I just want to fucking go home. Like, I just need to go home. Like, I'm not cool anymore. Like, this is not cool. And this is like before cell phones, right? Like, I'm just like, I am fucking like, I shouldn't be here right now. I don't know any of these people. It's dark and I'm scared and I just want to go home. So, you know, and like you could tell they'd established a safe home environment for her because she identified it with safety and personal safety. Mm-hmm. And I really love the parts about where, in absence of that, she reaches out in the dark for any semblance of that. And I really love that her relationship with Tinkerbell and Ami Tsunago, where they tell her early on, like, we got you. Like, mm-hmm. no matter what happens tonight, we're going to make sure you're safe.
Yeah.
And she really, right? So they become her surrogate family in a real quick way, those two in particular, right? And I thought that was really powerful. And I thought that was really great, that relationship between the three of them in particular. And I just, if you talk about sort of, because it is a retelling, but you know, obviously it's the cast is much more representative of today's, or what we know of today's, you know, society. And you've got so many different sort of shades of life, mm-hmm. you make a lot out of a very little. I think you do a really great job of, but making it feel so natural. And I thought those two characters in particular really are the best examples of that. It's just, talk about sort of like Tink and Ami a little bit, and sort of just the idea behind like creating, because this night, this book's almost told in real time, by the way. It happens just in one night. And your plotting is amazing in this book. And I know you've said you're a bit of an architect, so it's amazing that you were able to sort of like spell this whole thing out. You know, I'd love one time, maybe later on, you know, later in the year, get back and talk about sort of your entire process for plotting this story out, even break each chapter down. But we won't have time today. But talk about Tink and Ami, and just sort of like creating that sort of surrogate family for Wendy when she's out in this fucking maelstrom of a night that she put her through.
So one of the things that I was like really, really, that I love discussing is adults who are not safe.
Right.
There are like a couple of, as a adult writer of children's fiction, my perspective on what should be placed in a book to teach a certain lesson is like a primary focus of mine. For this book, I really wanted to talk about adults that aren't safe, and also the meaning of home and family. So throughout the book, Wendy goes by many adults that, if you were the kind of adult who was like, if something bad is happening, just find an adult. Like, they are not the adults that you can kind of go to. So the only people that she can trust is other teenagers. And I love elevating other teenagers as the ability to like fix problems and work together, because teenagers can and do fix their own problems, and they are abandoned in ways that make it so that they're the only ones who can fix their own problems. So I wanted to like honor that. But the first adults that she's with when the things are bad, they start out fine and they rapidly become bad. Mm. So things are already kind of bad, and she is surrounded by police. And Wendy is an African-American girl. She's mixed race. Her mom is full African-American. Her dad is white. And she's mixed race, which is relevant to the twist at the end of the book. But so she is a girl who is just made it to the city for the first time, has probably only seen, you know, the way that police handle African-American people in big cities, like on television or something. So she's really, really anxious about it. And she's like, I don't feel comfortable just going over to a cop and being like, I'm being kidnapped. Like, they're going to think that I'm doing something, and they're just going to take me to the police station. I'm going to have to deal with whatever happens there. So she's really scared. So she can't go to them. Later, she is with some drag queens, and they're able to kind of tangentially provide help, but they're at work. Like, sometimes adults can't help you because they're too busy, you know? So they're doing their own thing, and they're just like, okay, we don't know what's going on with you, but like, we literally have to be on stage in like 5 minutes. Like, we're going to help you out with a little bit of good luck. And she's like, okay, cool. Okay. Back to dealing with my own problems. Then later she runs into Detective Hook and the Crocodile, who are also adults, but they're violently dangerous upon first glance. And like, as she like kind of goes through this night, she gets these like mini opportunities to kind of like maybe reach out, but none of them are particularly as safe as where she is, which is a really good vehicle for keeping the story going in the direction, you know, that it needs to be to get to what happens at the end. But in regards to like Tinkerbell and the Tiger Lily replacement character, I really wanted to create an environment that uplifts an aspect of Peter Pan that was good in the original, was good in the Disney movie, and is good now, mm-hmm. Which is the found family. And as somebody writes, likes to write LGBTQ stories, found family and building community is like a huge part of that culture. So I wanted to spend some time kind of like elevating and illustrating that through showcasing what the Lost Boys look like as a family before they meet Wendy. In the original movie, it's very much a like, oh, we're quote unquote, you know, just kind of living wild, like wild people and stuff like that. When Wendy comes, she brings civilization. And there's like, you know, imperialist back thought of that because it did come out in like 1904. So of course they're being colonialist and imperialist about what they think about quote unquote savages. But there's this thing that's happening when she meets the Lost Boys where they have a dining room table, they have a house, the house has decoration, it has art in it that the boys have made. One of the boys is the like family cook and he makes this really big, beautiful meal from scratch for them because they can just afford from scratch. So it's like implied that they're on food stamps. So he makes the food and they sit down and they all have like a little before dinner prayer and they eat and everything like that. And there's this huge understanding that like within this community of only boys that are only children, there is a mom boy, a dad boy and children boys. And they've formed this surrogate nuclear family to help each other survive.
Right.
And then, so that's like the, you know, original version of it. And then I have like a secondary version where it's like, characters that are new to the story, Tinkerbell and my character's name is Ominotago. Mm-hmm. She is Ojibwe. They have their own more familial version of that, familiar version, which most kids who are in, you know, LGBT communities or even just have really close friends would recognize, where they have, you know, the dad friend, the mom friend, the, you know, cool, you know, joker older brother friend, the, you know, sassy younger brother friend, but they're all like, they all have families, they all have, you know, responsibilities, and they all have to be home at some point, you know. And where Wendy fits within those semi-dysfunctional and also functional relationships showcases a type of family that her family is trying to create because they're trying to adopt more children and they want to create that warmth and that comfort and that like familial support that exists both in the dysfunctional family and in the other family in their home.
I thought you did a really great job of like making that whole, everything you just said, that situation seem like it's got to be appealing somewhat, right? You have to lean into that sort of idea, right? That like Neverland, it's supposed to be if like there's slides and lots of, you know, great food and you do a great job with, this is where like some of the fabulous stuff comes in, right? You twist a lot of the great old tropes, but make them more modern, make them reflect today's sensibilities more for sure. But you know, you certainly present like, man, this place seems great, right? Like a fun, cool place. It's like a weird 90s.com business or something, right? Everyone's on beanbags and there's art everywhere and everyone's doing a great, it's like, who wouldn't love this, right? But you never let Wendy off the hook. You never let us off the hook because we are Wendy essentially, right? That's our point of view. So, you know, there's always that element of danger, that element of darkness. And one, you know, speaking of which, like, one of the ways you establish that is like something you mentioned earlier about sort of Peter Pan's true characterization. So Peter Pan, you're Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up, right? He's both beautiful and tragic at the same time. And I love that, how you lean into that too. And I like, this is one of the things I like about, you know, Aidan's book did it too. All these great things about, he's very fluid. His personality is fluid. Everything about him is fluid. He's, you know, he's entertaining. He's a thrill seeker. He's a high to be around. And I love this weird idea that you can't say no to him. You're attracted to him. You don't even know why you're attracted to him. I mean, he's clearly just a handsome fella, but that's too surface. That doesn't even begin to describe what you're feeling when you're around him. You know what I mean? He's like a drug almost to be around, isn't he? Talk about sort of your Peter and how you wanted him framed. It's hard maybe without spoilers if you can, but who's Peter to you?
So, and by the way, I've read Aidan's book. It's gorgeous and very sympathetic. My Peter's a little, you know.
His Peter, His Peter's great. Again, this isn't good. This isn't better or worse, right? This isn't like which book is best. It's nothing like that. I really enjoyed Aidan's book quite a bit. And but it's a different take. It's just, I'm sorry, that's a fact, right? It's a different look. Yeah. It's a different take on Peter. So
yeah, I'm actually a huge fan of Aidan Thomas. I blurbed Cemetery Boys.
Cemetery Boys is genius. Like he's Aidan's a genius. Yeah, there's no doubt.
Super talented. I love him so much. We've actually done a decent amount of Peter Pan marketing events together. So like I've gotten used to talking about his book, you know, along with Mom. We're like cousins in this structure.
Yeah, they pair well. They pair really well, right? Because mm-hmm. they're contemporary, right? So yeah. and like I said, like his is great, but it's like I said, I found myself wanting it to go a little darker. So I think it just that's just more about me than him or you, I guess. But but anyway, sorry, Peter Pan.
So Aidan, I want to talk about Aidan's Peter Pan in the same breath as I talk about mine.
Right.
Aidan did like kind of like a deep dive, very like psychology student perspective, because that's what he was studying when he was working on this. His Peter is very much a, what justifications can we give for the behavior of somebody who is obviously damaged, mm-hmm. which is like, I'm about it. Like I'm right there with you, you know. My perspective is, and I had a quote about this, right? I said something like, if Peter is a child, we can create leniencies for his actions, but if he is an adult, then what are the weight of his transgressions?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, you know, that is very much like what my book is hyper-focused on. It's focused on everything that Peter did in the original book, he does in this book. And it simultaneously makes him, you know, like attractive and interesting and beautiful and compelling and stuff like that, while also making him monstrous in many ways. And my Peter is, well, let's just talk about what Peter is and what he does. He's very beautiful, obviously. My Peter is like, he looks like he's, you know, maybe like 17, 18, 19, something like that. Definitely older teenager. Everybody in my books is all 17 most of the time. Mm-hmm. He...
For a reason.
Yes. I refer older teenagers because all the stuff they write is vaguely explicit. Yep. Anyway, so...
Well, plus, and also it's tied to... Yeah, it's tough to talk about. But anyways, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So he does a couple of things. He gives people nicknames that they didn't ask for. Which he does in the original book and in Darling.
Right.
He calls Wendy Darling, Darling, throughout the entire book. He cries a decent amount.
Yes.
And like I'm somebody who's like, you know, boy should be allowed to cry, like full, you know, men's tenderness rights, you know. But he cries as a manipulation tactic. And he does it in the original book and he does it in Darling. He does it when he first meets Wendy and he's not getting what he wants, which is his stuff that he came to take from her house, which in the original book is, you know, he's just messing around, but in Darling, it's his shadow. So his jacket, he has this like gray jean jacket that has been his for a really long time. And he rips it trying to break into her home. And then he cries and doesn't know how to fix it himself. So she sews it back together for him in the same way that Wendy sews his shadow back onto his feet. And so he cries in front of her. He cries when he thinks that she's starting to notice that he is a serial killer, like to distract her and be like, I'm so sad that this night isn't going the way I wanted it to. All I wanted was to show you a good time. You know, he cries. He is very authoritative. He presents the projection of, you know, there are no rules. There's nothing, you know, nobody can tell us what to do. There's no parents, stuff like that. But he is the parent. He is the authoritarian of the environment that Wendy, Tinkerbell, Tiger Lily, and all the Lost Boys are in the original book and in Darling. And when pressed about that, he will verbally deny it, you know? And then also he courts danger with no care whatsoever to the people around him. So like in the original Peter Pan, like he would do stuff like, oh, let's go jump off this thing. Let's go play with the mermaids who, you know, want to bite you. Let's go do this. Let's go do that. And like for him, all those activities are safe because he's the Peter Pan. But for Wendy and for, you know, her brothers, they're not welcome here. They're guests. They don't know how any of this works. And he doesn't care that they're in danger until there's an opportunity to make himself like a hero to rescue them. And Peter also has those features in my book as well. And I didn't add or take away anything from his personality. The only thing that I altered from that, which is genre specific, is that he can't do magic or influence. There's no magic in it, but what he can do is sleight of hand magic.
Right.
So he has this thing about him where he can almost like pull things out of thin air, pickpocket things off of people, and just like do all this stuff that makes him seem even more magical while just being basically like a weirdo thief guy.
So that's the thing. Like, so, you know, when the thing about Darling, I think, is, you know, you didn't, and that's exactly right. And I think that's kind of really the clever and genius part of this book, is that you really don't change Peter Pan at all. Mm-hmm. You change the world around him. Actually, you change the way the world perceives Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the world is us. So if Peter Pan hasn't changed, then that means we've changed. If now all of a sudden we're, you know, not all, and I mean all of us, not you, you've been in on it, in on the act from day one, obviously, but you know, the rest of the general viewing audience is now getting up to speed on the fact that, you know, Peter Pan's, it wasn't just like the coolest kid in the world, right? Like there's some issues there for sure. So if he isn't changed and the world has changed, that means, so one, you know, A plus B equals consequences. And because when you want to live in a modern society with rules and laws and you know, detective hooks, mm-hmm. you know, when there are rules, that's the thing with Neverland. The whole premise is there's no rules, right? That's like, do whatever you want, say what you want, eat what you want, whatever. Now, when there's rules, there's consequences. And one of the things I liked about this is such a great lesson for Wendy this night. I mean, I would love to meet 20 years Wendy from now. Right. And be like, hey, remember that night? Right. Like that, you know, can significantly change your life forever. So we're running out of time here. But talk about sort of, you know, one of the words that comes to mind when we talk about Peter, your Peter for sure, grooming. And, you know, is this a cautionary tale?
In a way, there is, Wendy has a love interest, and the love interest is not Peter.
Right.
He's another boy. I created, his name is Theodore.
Yes.
He's a Russian American kid. And the way that Peter tries to seduce Wendy, and the way that Theodore,
he's my representation, by the way, for for identification.
Just so lovely.
Yes, just so you know, like that's yeah, I'm biromantic and asexual. So he was like, that's my guy.
Yeah, Theodore is a biromantic, asexual, very yep. flirty, very cute type guy.
Yep.
The way that he treats Wendy throughout the night is being aware that she is new to the city, and how he should treat somebody who hasn't been around in this, you know, in the streets, like whether she's scared or not. You know, the way that he approaches, you know, being interested in her and stuff is significantly more appropriate than the way that Peter approaches her. Well, and
asked for permission, right?
Which yeah, is he great. Asked for permission.
Which I love that. I love that. Yeah.
They go to a club, he asks for permission to dance, he asks for permission to kiss her, just all that stuff. So he's very,
yep.
I'm going to say appropriate. And I think in a lot of media that's designed for teenagers, there's a lot of inappropriate material that's modeled without anybody officially saying it's inappropriate.
Right.
And, you know, whether or not it's, for example, like in Pretty Little Liars, there's a teenager who dates a teacher and nobody says anything about it, really. Like, it's kind of glossed over, like, oh, that's kind of bad a little bit, but like nobody really talks about the details of that. I think that it's my job as somebody who is making material that is to be consumed by children to at least talk about what it is that is appropriate and model inappropriate, and what it is that model what it is that should be appropriate, you know.
Well, that's like the only thing, that sex shouldn't be the only consensual thing when we interact with people, right? Like there's much more to interaction than just sex, right? So and then that's one of, and to your point, that's exactly, like, Fedora is so great at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, when you're designing a book, it's not so much that you're designing a lesson book where it's like, oh, I'm going to teach you something or
right,
whatever.
Right.
It's more that, like, once you're modeling poor behavior or modeling good behavior, there has to be a, like, general understanding of what is good and what is bad. In my first book, The Wicker King, it's about a, you know, unreliable narrator doing a lot of horrible stuff, and he winds up going to jail. And it's just, like, you know, really chaotic and stuff like that. But throughout the book, every single other character says, hey, are you sure you should be doing that? Like, I don't know if you should be doing that. Like, maybe don't do that. That's not very good. Even though he's the unreliable agent, he's like, I think it's very good. Mm. I'm having a wonderful time. Mm. You know, there's still that, like, you know, this omnipresence of this is what would be the best way to handle the solution. This is the way that the solution is being handled. And this is the eventual consequence of that solution and how they managed to grow from the experience of learning that. And in Darling, Wendy is experiencing what it is like to break the rules and do something her parents didn't want her to do, to meet people, understand that people have harsher lives than she does, because she's kind of a little bit well off, to meet a guy that is one of the first guys that she's ever met and been attracted to and been dazzled by, and then rapidly meet another guy and be like, okay, is this more healthy than the first thing that I experienced? And then, you know, what she does and how she, her being there impacts the like safety, well-being, and general success of what everybody else is experiencing on this single night. And that is what Darling is about.
Well, that's a great spot to end it. So this will air, you know, around the release, probably a day or two after, but, you know, is there anywhere in particular you'd like people to buy this book? You got a home field, a homer spot you like to shout out, or?
I do. So Barnes & Noble, I think, gives me the most money. But if you buy it from Women and Children First, that is my local Chicago bookstore, Women okay. and Children First. It is one of the oldest lesbian bookstores like in that region of the country. So if you could order from them, I would be very happy.
Women and Children First, that's a great name for a bookstore. It's a great name for any business, certainly. So yeah, this will air after, but June 22nd, this book comes out. Listen, as you can tell, I'm not prone to bullshit. I just really love this book, and it's unflinching. It's scary. It's pulsating. Like it's because it has this sort of like real time sort of sensibility to it. It takes place, like I said, over one night. It's one of these books that you can't put it down. Like you just can't, because like you're not allowed to, because it's like watching an episode. What was that stupid show with Sutherland? 24.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you can't, there's no way you like pause that and then go out for a bit and come back later. Right. Like there's just no way. And Darling is exactly like that. Like I, you know, read it straight through in record time, and it's such a great read. It's so, there's no way you're going to stop, because you have to know what the hell's going to happen. And while you do this is a retelling, you do, you know, sort of flip the script a little bit on the end in a wonderful and surprising way, actually. There's a really cool thing at the end, and I don't think people will see it coming. I didn't, but I am not the bellwether for intelligence. So anyways, Kayla, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I really appreciate it. All the best of luck with the release. This is not your first book, so you know you're not going to get any sleep the night before, but try and get some rest at some point in the next few weeks. And if you want to come back in a few months and we can maybe do spoilers and go chapter by chapter, I'd be all for that.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. I would love to do that.
Okay, let's do something like that. There you have it, another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Kayla for taking the time to chat with me. It was a real pleasure for me personally, as I'm such a big, big fan of this book. I meant what I said. Darling is now the bar to which all other Peter Pan retellings will be looking up to. It's that good, and I can't stress this enough. You need to read this book. Darling is out now, so head on over to kankrum.com, that's letter K, ankrum.com, to order a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinemalinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.